Hey, what's up, y'all? Welcome back to On Your Mental. This is the podcast that shares candid, open, and sometimes vulnerable conversations. I'm one of your co-hosts, Ruben.
I'm the other guy, Kabir.
Hey, nice to see you, Cavs. Welcome back.
Yeah, no.
No?
No.
You were here the last one.
No.
You were here. Anyways, today we're joined by an amazing guest, Dr. John Olive. John is the founder and lead researcher of the UBC Men's Health Research Program. Pretty wise guy.
Yeah, you know? And he's Australian.
And he's Australian, so hell of a voice. You're going to love it. But we get to talk about masculinity in mental health and in relationships, because that's always a hot topic on here. So we had a great time just getting to sit and listen and reflect on some of our own experiences, which was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
And we think you're all going to get a lot out of this episode as well. So sit, enjoy, grab your coffee, grab your drink, whatever you're doing. And we will see you in a moment when the episode starts. Peace. Welcome to the podcast, John Olive. We have been anticipating this. Kabir and I have been talking about it for a while.
We almost wore a suit today.
Almost. Yeah, he thought about it.
Whipped out my tux.
Yeah. But yeah, we've been really looking forward to getting this down and hear from you. Before I ask you a little bit about yourself so the audience knows, we met you at a Movember event at the end of last year. It was a Whiskey Turtlenecks health panel. Yeah. And that was a great night on its own. But so many of the guests we've had this year have come from that event, actually. And now we've got you.
Ah, it's like a draft.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
The only reason we went to the event.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping I went in the first round anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, cool. You were top of the list. Yeah. But you were there speaking, and you were talking about men's mental health and the perspective that you bring to that. And I think that's a good point where I can maybe ask you to tell a little bit what your perspective is. What is it that you do in this space of men's health? And what do you have to say today, essentially?
Yeah.
So, why should we listen to you?
Yeah. So I guess what got us started with the whole piece around men's mental health was very much around this, what we know is a discordant relationship. Like, men aren't diagnosed with depression as often as women, but they're suiciding at, you know, 3-4 times the rate. And, you know, we often refer to it as like this black box where we don't understand exactly what's happened in that flight recorder between the pathways from severe depression to suicide. And I'm not saying depression is the only route, but I am saying that, you know, we know that it's a real risk factor. So we just got super interested in that. And we've done a ton of work in gender and the whole bit around masculinities and as an explanation for why blokes don't go to the doctor or that they go to the doctor and they're not really sure about how to engage the treatment, because I think it's very complex in mental health, as are the pathways to get there. So that kind of got us our start to start looking at that. And you can imagine research is often about more questions than answers.
Yeah,
and constantly. Yeah. All of a sudden it's 20 years later and we're still kind of finding our way, but we think we've come up with some good things along the way that are helpful to think about and are helpful in terms of, you know, remedy in our lives, in our own lives and in guys' lives around us, and by extension, every time we help a bloke, we help their family and we help their partners, and, you know, so the flow-on effect.
And I like the just the sentiment there, and what you're talking about is this like cascading effect of who you help, and that it's more than just the person in front of you a lot of the time as well, and that can be just another reason to want to care about your fellow man, you know?
For sure, because we still get called on the thing, like, why men? And, you know, that can be your intervention point or your audience that you're trying to make a difference with directly. But those flow-on effects, time and again, you see them for everyone around. A guy who's struggling, when he's doing a little bit better, things tend to be good for everybody around him. And oftentimes that support is really key as well.
Absolutely. Now, when you say we, and you say we doing research, who's doing the research? Who are you involved with? What's your role and all that?
Look, it's really just me and a website.
Yeah. Just Google.
No, I've got some really good people that have been Jonah Grosnichuk, Dave Keeley from UBC Psychiatry. They're really good fellas and been in space with me for a long time. Zach Seidler, Simon Rice, terrific blokes from Australia who I know and work with. So there's been a few of us that have kind of buddied up.
Mm.
And I liked the story about that we have buddied up.
Mm-hmm.
Our gig in research is often really competitive. And I think that for blokes, oftentimes, is pretty competitive generally.
Just in general,
but
yeah.
But in our gig, it's like, you know, you kind of, it can be really competitive. It hasn't been with us guys. We've been a really good team. So I'm super proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
And especially as you get on and older and you can see the sunset on a career, it's great to have these young blokes coming up and you can step out with some kind of, you know, grandiosity about a legacy effect.
Right, yeah.
Or something like that.
Something like that. You've done something, yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like when talking about mental health, when you're with like a group of guys that really does care about it, there isn't a competitiveness. It's not like, oh, I'm doing better than you are. Nothing like that. It's all just like people wanting to see men's mental health improve. If you're bought in, that's kind of just like the effect that I feel like there is across the board. There's, I think, a challenge to overcome with some folks of getting people bought in even to the idea that mental health is worth talking about. Definitely. I think that's something that's still out there, even in our generation and in younger generations too. But when you're bought in, I think that the competitiveness goes away. It's like, yes, this is an important cause. We're all in with that.
Yeah, you know? I agree. Mm-hmm. And it has been, you know, a product and process of that collaboration. Mm-hmm. Those collaborations have just been, we're just playing to people's strengths.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the work we do, I'm not great with numbers. Those guys are great with numbers. I'm great with qualitative, you know. So we play to our strengths. Mm-hmm. And it's been just a delight.
That's awesome.
You know, so I agree with you that you look out for each other in ways where, you know, that whole competitiveness is gone and you just you're really just about personal bests and being the best you can be for other people. Mm-hmm. Especially other blokes. When you drop all that bullshit,
yeah.
It's just easier. Mm-hmm. It honestly is easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Makes you so much more open to other people, you know?
Yeah.
So thank you for giving us a bit of background about like what you're bringing to this conversation here. But what we planned on talking about today was going to be masculinity and how it impacts mental health as well for young men. And then we're also going to talk a little bit about relationships and masculinity too. So I'm looking forward to all of this, but maybe to anchor us here, if we can talk about masculinity directly, John, how would you maybe define masculinity at this point in your career and in your understanding of it today, if there even is a definition you could give to it?
Yeah, for sure. So our work is, and especially my early work, and still to this day, we drew on a theorist called Raewyn Connell.
Mm.
And the book that's, you know, transcended a lot of disciplines, including health, is called Masculinities. And I think the answer's right there.
Mm.
Like, so there's the notion that there's a plurality about how to be a guy.
Mm.
But what she does is she talks to these dominant ideals, and they might be about power and control, which guys can have an orientation to, and it's idealized as guys being decisive, powerful, controlling of their circumstances, and sometimes that bleeds into other people's lives. And also this piece around self-reliance, being strong, being stoic, not saying too much.
Mm-hmm.
So there's these ideals. And then what Connell did was talk about marginalized, subordinate, complicit, and protest masculinities as this kind of rubric about how you align or don't align with these ideals. And it's just a neat framework to think about, because when you're talking about mental health or mental illness, oftentimes, guys will feel quite weak. They'll feel a bit subordinate, marginalized by their condition, not like they're keeping up with other guys, not getting to those powerful, controlled...
Those ideals. Hmm.
And so it's been such a lovely framework to work with. So we get data in from people, from guys, and we'll pore over this data about what they're saying. And Connell's framework has helped us think about it. So long answer to your question, but it's just to say that I would define it as a plurality of performances that you learn that you're socially conditioned to learn.
Mm.
And we spend a lot of time undoing them in our own lives as we grow.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's ones that just feel like they're not states, they're traits, like they're things we can't break with.
Mm.
And I would argue that they're all states, and with your own work and good people around you, you can start to think differently about some of those pressures, because there's a lot of pressure. If you want to be a powerful guy, like there's a lot of pressure because someone's always going to be better than you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, that's just that's a cul-de-sac that is, right? So it's just trying to think about how to be. And I often encourage blokes to think about their values and their virtues. Mm-hmm. Instead of the norms that are out there.
Instead of trying to fit into like a mold that you think there is. We were talking about just the other day, Kabir and I, we were talking about masculinity and how like you can have, I guess, states, as you're saying it, right? We were saying, I think maybe like traits, that kind of idea that they can be expressed in at varying levels across men, but I like this idea of a state instead of a trait, that it's something you come in and out of.
Yeah.
Essentially.
And the plurality, oftentimes you think about how you are in the front bar of a pub. Not that you guys are doing front bars, but I grew up doing front bars.
What's a front bar? Yeah,
a front bar of a pub is, in Australia, it's guys.
Mm.
It's guys drinking.
Together. Oh, that's like, right? That's, oh, sure.
Oh,
sure.
You got that?
Yeah, I'm picturing it. Yeah.
Anyway, so
the other guys,
how I would present there would be very different to how I'd present on a date.
Definitely.
Right? Yeah. So there's the plurality is about the context as well. It's not saying my state is fixed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, dude, I'm fitting in wherever I go.
Right.
I'm trying to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm malleable depending on context.
Right. Are there states that seem to be more or less consistent across most men? That's a question I'm now wondering, just hearing you say that. Because like I get that, like you are just trying to fit in where you are. And for those who identify as someone who feels masculine, right? Yeah. I'm trying to do that in a way that feels masculine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So in health and in a general way, in mental health and in young men's lives, especially, they're often trying to formulate identity.
Mm.
And so that your reference point is often your mates.
Sure.
Yeah.
So then it can become about one-upmanship really quickly.
Mm.
It can be about mirroring what you're seeing or who you're hanging out with. And so we learn a lot of those things. And so it's interesting. Those states change depending on context as you get older, as you start to realize that there's a lot of bullshit that you might have bought into.
Sure.
You know, again, it's just working your way through it. So it changes across the life course. Mm-hmm. So we talk to guys, you know, in the health context, and they're really, like we say, they're really self-reliant young men.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't take professional help. Like they just want to manage it themselves.
Right.
And then we might also see guys be self-reliant as in, I got a problem, I'm going to address it with some professional help with a view to self-managing it effectively.
Hmm.
So there's this pivot on those states. Mm-hmm. Those states can work for you.
No kidding.
or they can work against you, and it's a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
There's times when you see a guy just leverage really well with self-reliance to manage, self-manage.
Mm-hmm. This very much just, it sounds as though, you know, masculinity is a bit of a spectrum, you know, in that sense, right? That there are different ways that each person fits into their own sense of what masculinity is, and it changes to and from the context that you're in, right? That's essentially what you're saying, or correct me if I'm wrong in understanding that, right? But yeah, that makes me just think about being around the people, like your circle, whoever your circle is, and you tend to mirror what they're doing, right? It makes me think, like, if you just spent your time around a bunch of guys that all they cared about was drinking beer and going to the gym and going fishing, is that what you would think being a man is? You know what I mean? Like, how easily is it to sway out of those states if you've seen that in research too? And in any of your research that you've done, have you seen people make major pivots in their life in terms of what they think masculinity is?
So we've never formally researched it, but I would say that I think as you get older, you'll be able to reflect on the folks you hung out with and how much of it prevailed. And I have this belief that your mates have got to be interested and interesting, right? Like you have to be able to get past the, you know, the Broncos talking NFL, you know, like you have to be able to get past it and get some level of depth at not necessarily at crisis points, right? But just some depth, dude. Like just something more than the beer and Skittles, you know? And I think that, you know, that's something that you yearn for, and negotiating it can be really challenging. And I think that's when we cut bait sometimes on some mates, where we sort of go, I'm just not getting what I need from this friendship.
Nothing past surface level.
Right. And it might be that. Or you might be, yeah, I'm great doing that. Every 6 months I catch up with him. He's like a secondary mate. We get pissed. We enjoy it, you know, have a nice time. But for the deeper day-to-day stuff, no, it's like it's a six-monthly event for me, right? Like, so I think we make decisions. A lot of people, a lot of blokes, they'll get that in their intimate partner. So then the superficial stuff will be like that'll be the respite from the deep stuff in the partnership. But that doesn't account for the, you know, we've got very large numbers of single blokes. So it doesn't account for those guys who might actually be, I wouldn't necessarily say lonely, but might be alone.
Right. Yeah. Do you have a thought? I thought you were looking
at me. No, I was just trying to, that's clicking with me, the, you know, where you've got like a group of buddies with the hangouts are very surface level. But I mean, I'm resonating with that when you've got an intimate partner and that's where the depth is, right? And then you lose that and...
Yes.
I mean, we're talking about that later, I think. But, and then that's where you kind of realize, you know, you fall into it a little bit. You know?
Yeah.
I feel like you would then start to feel as though you've just got this facade up of like the way that you interact socially is not getting below the surface, right? Like you no longer have a means to do so. I feel like that very much speaks to the importance of like social connection for men, right? That we need to have that, and it needs to be more than just taking the piss out of each other.
So, I mean, I caught up with some mates recently back in Australia, and we all went to school together, and it was like being 15 again. And I enjoyed it because I knew like it's a night out, and I did enjoy it, had a lot of fun, but the whole night, not the whole night, but a fair portion of it was based on reverting back to teasing. We tease. Our connection is to tease, and we've got this humble thing where like we do the tall poppy syndrome. If you at all get big on yourself, we will cut you down very
quickly.
Like, dude, don't be doing grandiosity on me. And so we do that. So it's like everyone's just like taking the piss, self-effacing humor, and then they're getting teased. It's like you come out of there going, oh, I had a really good night, but I don't know how much of this I can do. So, but I loved it. But it reminded me of how far you come. And just to clarify, that night we did get into some depth. So we actually did talk about how masculinities have changed. So that was quite buoying for me as well. But and just how the way we were at school and how we were competitive and how we probably teased people, but in today's frames we would have been bullying.
For sure.
We've talked about this before, even just to each other.
Right.
You know what I mean? What we got away with as kids, you wouldn't get away with anymore at all. And I can only imagine even more for your generation, right? I mean, you see the same.
Because
you know?
The dudes are all saying if there was social media, we'd all be cancelled.
Yeah.
Like if we were growing up with social media, that'd be it. So it's just, anyway, it's just there's a thought, a bit of a not a rumination, but a casting back to go, you know, I wonder where that was coming from. And one of my mates was actually saying, where did it come from? We were middle class. We had good opportunities. Why were we angry? And I said, I don't think we were angry. I just think we were caught in that competitiveness, in that whole teasing culture. That's the only way we knew how to connect, you know. So it was kind of socially constructed.
Yeah. Yes. I feel like it is. I feel like it's almost like a necessity for, like, our best friendships are with people that we went to high school with, and the people that we did, like, just make jokes with half the time, right? Yeah. Yeah. But they're also the people that I feel closest with, and they're the people that know the most depth in me, because you eventually get through that bit, you know. It's almost like it warms you up. It tells you that you're okay to be vulnerable, like a bouncing back and forth of like, fuck you and all this like bullshit, like joking stuff almost tells you like, okay, like they're in this with me. I can't open up. Oh, by the way, like I've been having this trouble with my girlfriend or whatever. Like it just comes up, you know, and then now you get to that point in the conversation. And I think sometimes it's necessary.
What I've noticed recently though, is because I'm working at, I work at rec centers in around Vancouver. But so there's a lot of kids around, a lot of youth, and I don't know. I feel like we started this kind of roasting thing. We didn't start it, but we've started engaging in it. I would say for myself, somewhere around high school, maybe early high school.
Yeah,
I'm seeing elementary kids doing like the same, but they're at the same level that we were in high school.
Oh God!
So I'm not sure if it's starting earlier, and I'm not sure if there's any pros and cons to that, you know, as well, because they are going pretty hard at each other sometimes.
I'd have my suspicions as to why that is, and my thinking would be it's exposure. Right, when you talk about not having social media growing up, I mean, we were just starting to when we were growing up, right? Like we had Facebook when Facebook started to become like mainstream, but that was about it. Facebook and Instagram. I think Snapchat came out while we were still in high school. We didn't have TikTok. No. You know, we didn't have this thing that just permeates, and you see people in an older demographic already. You pick up, you mirror, right?
You do.
You're trying to fit in. And I feel like maybe they're just seeing that and they think that that's normal. So now they bring it down even younger. That's interesting, man.
Yeah.
The fact that you're seeing that.
And you know, the village that I grew up in was like small. It was tiny. It was my high school. But you and subsequent generations, their village is massive.
Right.
They're
like the metaphorical village they've got.
They're a click away from the world, right?
Yeah.
Not even. You know, like they're carrying the world around in their phones. So it's like all of this, you know, this hegemony or this dominant ideals of masculinity, damn, they're everywhere, right? So you can get exposed to all of these different tilts and taints that like weren't there in your little teasing culture growing up in high school, football team.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot more stuff out there.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
Yeah.
Like the idea that there's just that much more access to information and perspective, and there's no filter. Like there's really not much of a filter to it, to what they're then taking in, because like to that point, going through the halls, you just had each other to talk to. You weren't just scrolling through your phone through 30-second videos onto the next, and then like sit down and talk with your friends. You know what I mean? Like we were just walk and find each other, talk, hang out, shoot the shit, go home. You know, like we didn't have that. What are your thoughts on like seeing? I know this isn't like a planned thing, but I'm just curious if you have any opinion on
it. It's a tough one. I know some guys find solace in it, you know, so they find some level of connection in it or some level of happiness in it. But I agree that human connection, I think if COVID taught us anything, I think it did teach us the value of being there and being sort of able to touch and feel and know each other. So I thought that was like really important. And I think where that the internet comes up short on that. And also I agree the information is, I mean, it's just information.
Yeah.
And I watch, you know, some folks in our class, they'll have they're fact checking you as you're trying.
Yeah, as you're talking,
which I find kind of weird. But you know, like, so there's lots of different ways of knowing and lots of different information out there. And I think it can just remove you from some of the things that are really useful. And you know, and this is self talk too. You know, I do a lot of the stuff with the iPods in, and I'll do my five song run and, you know, I'm just tuned out. And then I'll think, oh, well, I'm going shopping. I'll have them in and just not have to talk to anyone and just.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just see people so isolating and isolated in those moments.
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't say g'day. Like,
yeah.
Like it's like, well, everyone's got their buds in. No point saying g'day, even if you could get the eye contact, which isn't always easy in Vancouver. Just to get that and go, hey, how you doing? You know, like, you know, you might get chased off.
Yeah. And I hate that though. I hate that because like I've always wanted to live somewhere where you can say, hey, how are you?
Like just more of a sense of community.
Because it definitely was, it felt more like that growing up, where I could even smile at the person I'm walking by.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's a little more rare.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember walking down to there's a pizza shop down on the corner by my place growing up. And my mom and I, we would go and get pizza every Thursday because we'd watch Survivor. So we would go and walk down to the pizza shop and like you'd walk by people on the way there, but then you get there and it's like a big hello to the pizza shop guy. Right. Like I'm just like a little kid. Yeah. There's a candy store next to it and like everybody's just friendly. That sense of community feels like it's very quickly feeling like it's slipping away sometimes. Mm. Not to be like melodramatic about it or like, oh no, it's going away. But sometimes it feels like it does, you know?
Yeah. And COVID had, you know, not to belabor COVID because like I could do another conversation about that, but you know, just to say, I just was convinced, you know, of just how tough that was, for a whole variety of reasons. But you know, and so getting back to in person is great. Mm-hmm. Like I had assumed tonight I'd be phoning it in from.
Right, originally.
From the office until I looked at the notes and I went, oh, that's all right. That'd be good.
Yeah.
So, again, you know, it conditions you pretty quickly, right? So, anyway, just to say.
Well, thank you, John, for that kind of, I guess, overview of kind of what masculinity has looked like so far. We went on like some little tangents there, but I like this because these are striking up ideas in my head, right? Before I move on to like the next kind of question, path that I want to go with, did your definition that you've gone with and this rubric that you built off of, sorry, what was their last name?
Connell.
That rubric that you've been kind of following to guide how you approach masculinity, has that changed at any point in your time doing research in this field? Like, did you go into this with a different definition, or was it kind of seeing the way that she broke that down to see multiple masculinities, right, the plurality of it? Is that what really just brought you into it and then you went from there, or did it start one way and you found that?
Yeah, no, I did start with it.
Mm.
So it's so interesting. I met Raewyn Connell when I was just I was doing my PhD and I met her, but at that point it was Bob Connell. It was a him.
Mm.
And he transed to being a woman. And I loved the whole framework because it helped me think about the data that I was getting from my PhD. So to have met her was pretty amazing too, early on as a rookie.
Mm-hmm.
Really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And so it stuck with me, continued to do that work. There are lots of other theories now that are in and around. It's still my go-to, not because I know it really well, but because it still speaks to me.
Mm.
It still helps me make sense of things. So there are things now that are more around, there's one that I quite like and it's called inclusive masculinities.
Mm.
And it's this notion that the foundation for our masculinity won't necessarily be excluding people.
Mm, saying that you are not masculine.
Right.
Mm.
So it takes that next step. So you know, homophobia was usually the way in which you'd establish yourself in a heterosexual capacity, right? Like it's what you're not.
Right.
So then if you other that person or those people, even if they're suspect, then that would be a way of, you know, establishing yourself.
Right.
By what you're not.
Hmm.
And so the inclusive masculinity suggests that as boys and men are growing up now, that there's a relaxation around that. There's an inclusiveness where we accept and we see them, we see other guys by race, by sexual identity, a whole myriad of things, disability, as part of the masculinities.
Right.
And so that's where they've gone with that. I think it's helpful for contemporary times. Yeah. You know? I think it helps us really sort of frame a lot of the talk we do
mm-hmm.
in terms of it should be inclusive. We got about inclusive, equity, diversity, inclusivity. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. so it peddles that. And I think that's important to think about too.
Mm-hmm. You almost answered a question that I like just thought of as you were speaking there, which is like, do you feel as though the times that we are in now, contemporary times, are what allow that view of masculinity to exist? You know, like there isn't a need to protect in the physical sense necessarily as much now, you know, like in this westernized world that we live in, what it meant to be masculine and be a man is different than what it was 100 years ago, 50 years ago. Yeah. You know, we're not going off to war, thank God, right? Like there's a different definition, you know, or different things that you feel like you need to do in order to be a man. And then if you couldn't do those, you couldn't meet those, I guess, ideals, as we mentioned at the start of the conversation, maybe you would feel as though you're not there.
Yeah.
That you aren't being masculine.
So the shackles and the rigidities, mm-hmm. you hope, and this theory would suggest this inclusive masculinities, it's Anderson and McCormack, I think, if I'm remembering, are actually going there. They're actually saying it.
Mm.
So then it dispenses with the dominant ideal being, you know, the powerful white rich guy,
mm.
you mm-hmm. know, exerting power over people. It changes it. It says, oh, hang on, this plurality is what we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
Like this inclusivity. Anyway, I kind of like it. I think it's helpful for the current day. It's tough sometimes when you're looking at data to talk to it. You can in some ways. It's just a tougher frame because oftentimes we'll sample people of similar demographics and then it's like, it gets a little bit more complex, mm-hmm. right? So,
because it blurs the lines between like
right.
who fits into what and who is expressing masculinity.
Yeah. And
who
Connell's
isn't.
Stuff has been argued against in terms of that we might have got into categories which were unhelpful.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always argued that within those categories, there's still hierarchies and there's still relationships within those categories.
Mm-hmm.
I see lots of marginalized guys marginalize other guys.
Mm.
Like I see it all the time. I mean, right. so it's not even about the purchase of dominant ideals. It's about in their milieu, in their little part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
It's funny, at the beginning of our talk, you talked about how research, you're constantly researching. There's always more questions, right? I think that when you break things down into categories, it's very easy to understand that and that's easier to grasp. But when you start to blur those lines and it becomes this homogenized mix of understanding, like what masculinity is, that opens up so many more questions into, okay, how do we study this? How do we understand this?
Yeah.
I think it's a cool space to be in. Growing up a man now, I don't know if I even shared this with you. I'm growing up with just a single mother parent, right? So like I don't have the typical family dynamic to learn from a direct role model, like what it looks like to be a man. So I find this whole idea of masculinity in this new age interesting because I very much feel like a man. I feel masculine, but sometimes I wonder why I feel masculine. You know, like what is it about what I do that makes me feel masculine? I don't know that I even have an answer, but to that point though, the way we sort of express masculinity, I feel like we've kind of made it obvious that it varies, right? It varies from person to person, and that state that you're in is different from person to person. How do you feel as though it expresses maybe like across gender? You know, can masculinity be expressed by someone who doesn't identify as male?
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. So you could think of some of the stereotypical states
like strength, power, those kinds of things, right?
And I mean, one of our go-to emotions as men, which I think is socially constructed, but I see it in lots of different people, irrespective of where they are on a continuum of a binary between femininities, masculinities, anger, express
right.
anger. And I like anger's such a tough one for guys, and I imagine women and everyone in between, right? Those binaries, is because at some level, especially in men, it's kind of condoned. It's kind of like, well, we expect a dude to be aggressive. He's playing in the NFL. Like, I mean, what did you expect? You know, like, we expect that.
Mm-hmm.
But at another level, when we lose it in the everyday and we're justified for losing it because we convinced ourselves we are, and people around us go, yeah, I would have lost it too. But then there's this deep shame after where you're just left with that. You're like left with the shame of having lost it.
Huh.
Because we crave control too.
Mm-hmm.
And we just lost control.
Mm-hmm.
And it never comes off well. We never win really with aggression or anger. But it's often our go-to emotion. Huh. And my theory of that is that we oftentimes as blokes will have these emotions that will be discordant. They'll be like regret and relief at the same time.
Hmm.
And you're like sitting there and you're just angry because you can't make – you express anger because you can't make sense of the fact they're discordant. You're like, but hang on, I don't even know what I'm feeling and I don't know why. And a lot of times it's the release is to be angry, is to express anger rather than sit with the emotion and try and work it out and just let it run over you. Like feel it. It's all right to feel it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. It's a bit of a tangent.
No, fair. That you saying that piece, though, about men feeling regret and relief at the same time, for some reason, my mind jumped to like a breakup.
Right.
You know, like relief that you're leaving a relationship that you felt like you wanted to leave. Regret, did I make the right decision at the same time? You know, like I know I've felt that before, you know, that's interesting. I just feel like that's an interesting little piece there, you know. But yeah, I think that to your point, like, yeah, there are these, I guess, more stereotypical traits states that can be expressed by anybody, right? And we just associate it with being masculine. But you're also right saying, like, when I see a guy blow up and lose it in public, I'm like, what are you doing, man? Like, that's not cool. Yeah. You know, that doesn't seem too manly to me, man. Like,
yeah.
Keep it composed.
Yeah.
Right? I would feel like that almost looks more manly than anger these days.
But. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. And so, and oftentimes, you know, you talk to guys about where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because what you're expressing is just the expression. It's not the emotion.
Mm.
There's stuff underneath that.
How true is that? That there is like, you know, when somebody is having a bad day, you know what I mean? When they are blowing up on somebody else and you see it in public, I have a history of customer service and like retail, you know, and it's like, you know, when someone's being kind of a dick, you just got to tell yourself there's probably something going on. I don't know. How true is that? Like, is that something that research really does? Like, have you ever looked into that? Is there a way to look into that as to why men express anger because of things that are rooted?
Yeah. So my own theories around it, just from the kind of the sideline stuff we do, depression is often expressed as anger because you're sitting with emotions, you're ruminating on things past.
And you don't want to fucking sit with these emotions, man.
And you're like, oh, dude, I'm regretful. I'm just not okay with stuff. God, I should have done that better. Then throw in a little bit of anxiety, which is uncertainty about the future. Beautiful.
Yeah, what a mix there.
And so you're sitting on those two things. Oh, yeah, I'm really pissed about the past and my future's looking pretty bleak too.
Mm-hmm.
And so anger, but that's not it, right? So
anyway, that doesn't get you anywhere.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know.
But it makes me mad just hearing that. Oh,
yeah. I know. Yeah. Yeah. Imagine if it was like some driver of outcome, good outcome, but it's not. And most people get frozen. They get frozen with anger because it doesn't – you can't do anything. You cannot do another thing when you're angry.
Yeah.
Like you can't finish the essay. You can't finish the phone call.
Yeah.
It's like if you're angry, that's it. That just takes over. And it's just a trap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love the way you said that. It's not a driver of good outcomes. You know, it's like, I want to, like, for the audience, like, stick to that for a second as young men, you know, like, anger is not a driver of good outcomes. Rarely, if ever, are you going to get something good out of being angry.
Maybe in football.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe. You land a sweet tackle.
Yeah.
Right? But then you're coming away with a concussion.
The perfect situation.
Yeah. 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 In football, if you can intimidate the other person to put them off their game, then you could, you know, you could see that it might work, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. The rare occasion. That's,
yeah, I'm not playing football in the supermarket.
No,
fun as it might be.
No. Man.
Yeah. This whole like conversation so far about masculinity has been great. And I like just hearing more and more perspectives on it, which is wonderful. I was wondering if it's okay if I do share with you that quote that I had heard about masculinity, just to like get your thoughts on it. Because I found it very interesting. So let me pull this up really quick and I'll just share it with you.
Something Galloway.
Yes, from Scott Galloway. It was on the Armchair Expert podcast where I heard this. And I love the quote. And then afterwards, I was like, oh, I love what this guy's saying. So I started to go listen to more podcasts that he'd been on. And turns out he just kind of repeats a lot of the same stuff. And I didn't really like it anymore after that. But I still like the quote. So for full context here, that's the quote. The quote, and this is how he defines masculinity, was he defines it as garnering strength and skills such that you can protect and advocate for others. And I think I really liked that second piece, the advocate for others part, because I think that's what I identify with in being a man who doesn't feel like I need to go out and protect anything anymore. I don't feel like I'm protecting anybody. I don't feel like I have many people in my life that I need to protect, other than like, if I was with my mom, I'll protect my mom. If I'm with my girlfriend, I'll protect my girlfriend. But the advocating for others piece, I think that's really cool that you're garnering strength and skills in order to do that. But what do you think about that quote? Garnering strength and skills to protect and advocate for others.
Yeah, I really liked the last part. Like, so we're doing some work at the moment that's about guys and relationships.
Mm.
And there's equality, gender equality, and there's gender equity.
Mm.
Gender equality is that we do things 50-50, like it's a deal, you know? And if I'm out of kilter and I'm doing more than you, I'll let you know.
Right.
That's equality.
Yeah.
You can see the problems there. Gender equity.
We're never doing 50.
No, it doesn't work like that. But it's like, so, and gender equity is about what do you need?
Mm.
What do you actually need? Like, I know you well enough to know what you need. So I'm going to be a helper to assist. I do need some reciprocity. You need to know me and you'd need to be able to help me out.
And he's also ask you right? What you need.
Yeah. Mm. You'd have to know me well enough. And it's just such an interesting feel. So when you quote that, that may well be what you're suggesting, right?
That's in a way advocating for the other in front of you.
But you've got to know them well enough to do it. And in partnerships, like in couples, I hear time and time again guys will say, I've got to know him or her well enough to know what they need, to understand how things shift and what they need from me in that moment. And I might not always be right, but I'm always intent on supplying that.
Mm.
Also have expectations about what I need. Like I know myself well enough to know what I need. She understands me. Blah, blah, blah. So it's, I just think it's an interesting one because the 50-50 counts undo people.
Yeah.
You get into the count, dude. I've been doing all the cooking.
And it's almost like you're keeping score, right? Yeah. Right. I've done the dishes and I've cooked 5 times this week. What the hell are you doing? Yeah. I'm with you. But yeah, I thought that definition was interesting. I like the advocate for others part
because
it's like when you're talking about marginalized men as well, too, right? Like there needs to be people to advocate for those, right? Yeah. And to show that there is a place in society for people that don't feel like they do have a place, you know, especially in today where like your place is so fluid, like where do I fit in? And I just want to fit in, you know, you got to be able to advocate for others. And I think as men, it's our responsibility to do that sometimes.
Yeah.
You know?
And what do they need to feel like they have a sense of belonging and belong better still.
Mm-hmm.
But so what do they need?
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes you
and that's
can,
a skill to learn to ask that.
You can garner that for folks.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a smile and a welcome. A lot of times and a genuine interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You got to take those earbuds out though.
That's it. Got to get them out.
Thank you for all that so far. And to steer us more towards mental health, right? I mean, that's a lot of what we talk about here on this podcast with On Your Mental. It's a lot of what you get into with your research as well. But I'm kind of curious how masculinity in your lens, in your scope, John, how masculinity does influence men's mental health. You know, where does it play in? Where does it fit into that kind of construct, that umbrella like what are pieces of masculinities that sort of sway and affect how we look at mental health.
So I'll share, we wrote a paper about this, and it's called Injury, Interiority, and Isolation.
Mm.
So when a guy gets an injury, oftentimes we'll think that the injury is something that we should just get past.
Mm-hmm.
Classics are relationship breakups, but they can be things like retirement, coming back from war and reacclimatizing to civilian life, any of those things, you know, and lots more. They're transitions. And oftentimes guys will discount it as injury. And what happens over time is you deny it. You just deny the injury exists, but they accumulate. Because life's not, full of little injuries.
Mm-hmm. And not necessarily physical then is what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So these are injuries, these are insults, you know, that you carry. And if they're not dealt with, they accumulate. So then what we do is we tend to drive inward. We look for an inward resource. And often at a point when we're quite fatigued.
Hmm.
So we don't have the resource.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the easiest go-tos is a substance, because it'll buy us some time, it'll elevate our mood, it'll just get us some level of respite, but the next day is very unhelpful and everything that follows. So that interiority is our go-to, because we want to be self-reliant. If we've got a problem, we don't want to share it. We want to conceal it and deal with it. And then the third eye, isolation, is we so intent on people not knowing what's happening because we're associating it with weakness, that we isolate further to solve the problem. And one of the biggest risk factors for suicide is to isolate.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it's self-isolate. And I've seen blokes who have 100 people around them at work, they're all good, look totally connected, and they are so isolated because they're just not connected in a real sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's about carrying those injuries, about looking interior, and also not having resource, just not being able to solve it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So the masculinities part of that is like reticence for help seeking, reticence for professional help seeking, denial of injury, the estimation that you should be able to get past this, like lots of blokes from breakups, so I can get past this, you know.
And that you can get past it quicker than you might actually need to do so.
There.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I ain't gonna sit with it. And I'll drink it.
So take a duel.
I'll drink it out.
Yeah,
you know, like I'll get it done. However, I can get it done. I might be a bit dysfunctional. My mates are gonna be okay with it because that's what young men do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do the crazy, you know, irresponsible stuff. Like that's okay in certain cultures, and that they move in routinely.
Mm-hmm.
So then you pass as being okay a lot of times. So it can be really, really a setup that like a trap.
What I'm picking up here is that it's the not taking the time almost to sit with the feelings, the emotions, the injuries, you know, the bruise to your ego, whatever it is that's accumulating over time. It's not sitting with that and like being okay with it, truly processing it. It's rushing through that or telling yourself that this is taking too long to deal with, shutting it out through substance, through just not addressing it, right? Not looking at it. And then you get to a point where, as you say, like we don't want to show people that we are dealing with these things, but if it's the only thing on our mind, I can't be there with you. And so then I isolate. It's making sense to me.
It makes me think of my most recent breakup when, Ruben knows this. I didn't tell anyone.
Yeah.
After I just let the news spread from her side, and I thought that was I don't think I was trying to be particularly manly about it. It was more so. Well, I probably was. It was more so. I just kind of wanted to try it out as well.
Hmm.
But I think I was trying to be. I had a confidence that I could just kind of deal with it myself. And I think in turn, I don't know if you did the same thing.
Hmm.
Later,
yeah,
and then our friend AJ also did the same thing, and I'm not sure if I started that or something, but
I want to comment that on that. And I have a question too. Did you at all feel like you were doing that because you just didn't want people to ask you about it?
Yeah, it was a lot of that. Mm. It was mainly that. And I think I did have a confidence that I knew I was good because I'd been through breakups before, and it was very, the breakup was very similar to breakups I've had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
They never get easier though.
Yeah.
But I felt like it was just something I would get over.
But it wasn't a like, oh, this is something that's too sad for me to talk about. I don't want someone to ask me questions. Or was there a piece of that too?
It was more so that felt like a burden for me to bring upon my friends. Not that I needed a deep talk, a one-on-one talk or anything, but it was more of like, it didn't feel like a big deal for me, so I don't really need to bring it up.
Yeah. Classic men, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Totally hear you. Yeah. And it's so interesting. I think too, I mean, this is a question, because in our data, there was some element of guys not knowing what to say.
Yeah.
What do you say?
Right. Yeah. If I had been like, cause we've got like a little group chat and all that. If I'd been like, hey guys, me and her name just broke up. That almost sounds weird to me, just saying it like that. Like, I wouldn't even know how to interject it into any conversation. Mm-hmm. It would definitely feel more natural if it was in person with the group or even with one of the guys one-on-one. But I don't think at the time our hangouts may have been more scarce. But
wasn't that was mid-pandemic too?
It was mid-pandemic. Like
we weren't going to places.
It was mid-pandemic.
Was that 2020?
It was 2020.
Yeah,
played into it quite a bit as well.
For sure. Like we weren't getting together.
Yeah.
Right. We weren't gonna. You couldn't say like, "Hey guys, you want to grab a drink?" And then you spring it on us. You know what I mean? That's often such a simple catalyst for guys too. Like, let's go grab a drink, and then now here, let's get into the real conversation. But my thoughts on that, it was my last breakup, right? Where I didn't really tell anybody.
Yeah.
Right. And it was, my reason for not telling anybody was that the last couple times where I had, it was like, I didn't want to have to bring it up with you guys. You know what I mean? It's almost like I felt like this is my problem.
Yeah.
Why does it matter to you? Right. And I'm just going to get roasted in some way. Like, I didn't want to get like a joke thrown at me for this.
And it would have happened for sure.
For sure. Yeah. For sure. Like a
in
joke.
In a loving way, but for sure it would have happened.
Yeah. It's like, I didn't want to have to explain myself. I didn't want to have to like give you reasons. You know, I wanted to just deal with it by myself.
I think, you know, sometimes too, the guy who you might say something to about the breakup will... You're trying to protect him in some ways too, because you might be worried that he just doesn't know what to do with the information. And it's funny, a lot of times when people do confide, you'll be like, you as a man, oftentimes your go-to will be to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
Dudes don't want that. They actually want to process. They just want to talk.
Mm-hmm.
They're not asking you to solve it. And so there's this kind of thing too where – a lot of times I think with relationship breakups, you don't want advice because it's kind of like, you know, it was kind of an intimate thing with your partner.
Yeah,
it's
like, you can't have the full picture.
Even if you start dissing on her, like it's not going to be helpful. It's not. That's like you can take my side, but it's not going to be helpful for me. Like, so again, it's a really tough spot, I reckon.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Kev. I appreciate that.
Just reminded me of that. I think one of our friends also did that again recently.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard, but
probably not. Clearly not.
It was on the weekend.
He told
us in person actually. So it was more. I think it was very recent as well. So it was more natural.
Oh, I'm gonna have to. I'll tell you later. Figure it out after the conversation. And it's funny. Like just to hang on to this for another second here. It's like, I feel like part of it too is almost bad experience in the past of bringing it up, you know, cause the last times I had gone through breakups, it was like not the best situation. And I think I got the brunt of that. And it was almost like an I told you so kind of feeling the last time. So I was like, I don't want to risk it being anything like that now. So I'm just not going to mention that it happened the next time. You know, it's like a bad experience can sour you from wanting to bring something up again, you know? And it's just like a trauma response, you know, you're seeing like a certain way to approach something negative. But, to come back to masculinity and men's mental health and how they kind of interplay with each other, I think the clear piece there is the self-reliance, right? It's that we can figure stuff out ourselves. There's maybe a degree of impatience and a degree of like, we need to be moving on. Yeah. I got to do what's next.
Yeah.
And that I think can really prevent us from dealing with mental health totally the right way.
And I think, you know, we've got good evidence of that too. When a guy accesses help, and is actually in therapy, so to speak, or, you know, working with a counselor or whatever, that same thing, that impatience, that, if I've got to talk about my childhood one more time, I'm out of here, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah.
But I think what people have learned as providers and service providers is that you need to be really clear about, this is going to take some time. Here's some milestones that we're going to try and hit. Here's some dates we're going to try and hit them by. It's going to involve some take-home work. We're going to have to work between sessions. Here's my expectations about the way we're going to go. And I think, you know, that helps to waylay some of the impatience with a guy. And I'll often say to fellas, they'll say, I went, had a bad experience, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say, it's the same as your football team. They change the tactics all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They change their personnel. You know, you waive people, you draft people. It's going to take more than one ask.
Mm-hmm.
You're often going to have two or three. It's going to change over your lifetime if you're going to continue. Who's sitting with you now and working with you now is probably not going to be the person in 5 years. You're probably just going to have to keep building a team. And it really is that approach. And so we often position men's help seeking as if he just asks help. Well, a lot of guys do, but they're impatient or their expectations are out of whack in terms of, you know, like what it is. The flip is as well that there's some dudes out there that are providing services that aren't going to be a fit for you. So again, it's like purchasing the car or renting the car, whatever you do, it's a bit like deciding, you know, have I got some rapport with this person? And trying to work through that, especially talk therapy, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like often you hear stories about it being like a bit of a luck of the draw, you know? Like, did I get someone that I felt actually was helping me, you know? And again, that same point that I was just saying about having a bad experience with like sharing with my friends about a breakup. If you have a bad experience with a counselor or a therapist your first time, it can be very discouraging to think about trying again, to find someone else to fit that spot on your roster, that team, right? And that I think that happens all too often. You know, I was speaking with someone just today actually through email and talking about them starting with a counselor for the first time today would have been their first session. And in my head, I hope this is a good first session, you know, like I don't want you to have to like deal with finding another one. Cause that takes so much more courage on top of already that first ask from a guy to hit a point where they're like, yeah, okay, I am going to ask for help.
Yeah. And when you think about it too, oftentimes the guy will have come through a general practitioner. So he's already disclosed, I've got a problem. I need some help. So he'd done it there. Then he gets the referral. And that doesn't really seem to be going so good. And so then he's got another, got to go back, get another referral, you know.
How many times am I saying this is my problem?
And, you know, and then there's cha-ching, cha-ching, the money's dripping away. And so it's tough, but it's I think part of the resiliency that we need to talk to guys about is that resiliency to stay in that pattern of, yeah, look, I need something. And I'm going to find it and it will involve some professional help if they're to that point. And it might just be a short-term thing. They might get fixed and have the tools, given the tools or learn the tools to go forward. And that's often what a lot of people do. You know, it's just learning those strategies, you know. Yeah.
And to talk about masculine states for a second, resiliency. That's a masculine state for sure.
For sure.
You know, there's so much strength in that. And so like yeah, if you try and you reach out and you go down one of these avenues of typical talk therapy and counseling and that doesn't work for you, the resiliency to keep going and try to find something that does, that's huge.
Yeah.
Right. Like that, if you're questioning masculinity at that point, that's being masculine right there. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's that steadfastness. And it's super interesting to me that a lot of times I've just written a paper about this, and it's about vulnerabilities and resilience. And we often put the two together.
Mm.
So the disclosure of a vulnerability of something that didn't work out so well, and then the finish of the narrative is about your resilience. So guys will tell these stories all the time. Mm. The comeback story,
of course.
You know, drafted as Mr. Irrelevant and ended up setting the NFL on fire, TB12, right?
Mm.
All that, those kind of underdog stories, the vulnerability, the resilience. And I do think resilience is a muscle.
Mm.
And I do think we've got to work at it. And I agree with you, in its state, it works really well. Sometimes we're not probably at the top of our game in terms of that muscle development.
Mm.
And some of that's what we can learn too from others, from other blokes around us, but also counsellors can be really helpful in giving you a few tips around some of that stuff.
So ways to practice resiliency.
Yeah. Like to build the muscle, because it's probably there, but it's like anything, you got to kind of consciously think about, well, how do I mobilize that?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Interesting. Yeah.
Just breaking problems down, that CBT stuff, you know, just breaking it down.
Right, right. Cognitive behavioral therapy. Yeah, CBT. I got it.
That was a test.
Yeah.
Fast. Yes.
I think now will be a good point for us to kind of steer towards the thing that our audience loves to talk about, which is relationships. But in particular, in this context of masculinity and men's mental health, what is it about a relationship crisis that steers men towards looking for help and seeking some sort of support?
So I'll preface it by saying that many guys will stay in a distressed relationship for an extended period of time. They will either withdraw live within the relationship.
Guilty.
Yep.
Gotcha. My work is done. And or be engage in conflict.
Guilty.
Twice, dude. I'm about to cure you. Hang on for this.
Got my seatbelt on.
I lied. Sorry. and so those things become normative. You kind of in the relationship, but you're not really.
Mm-hmm.
You're just arguing in a relationship where you're meant to be in love. I mean, so. This ability to stay in the holding pattern is quite interesting, because the longer you're in the distress and neither of those two positions and everything in between is not okay, the worse it gets.
Right.
And so oftentimes it'll be this epiphany of a crisis, and it might be the partner saying, you either get some help, or we get some help, couples counseling, or I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
We're done. Like the ultimatum. And that's often a call to action for guys within relationships.
Right. When the partner who you're able to be deeper with is pointing out you got to do something different.
Yeah, we need a third party here. And the sanctity of relationships is interesting too, because I think as guys, oftentimes we'll think that we really should be able to handle it. In-house. And going outside of the relationship, oftentimes it's a condition of the relationship. So partners might say, hey, we keep it in-house. Everything's, you know, we protect this, and by protecting it, then we would solve our own problems. And guys really buy into that. A lot of privacy around relationships. A lot of times you have vulnerabilities in the relationship that you wouldn't be discussing or sharing with anyone else. They know stuff about you no one else knows, right? All of that. Because that's trust and intimacy. So, yeah, just to say that the help seeking is, it's barred for a lot of reasons, but usually it's a crisis point by which guys will kind of seek the help. Because it's not like you'd necessarily go see a counselor to say, hey, everything's going swimmingly great. I'm in the honeymoon period. It's like rocking. And, you know, can you help me? Yeah. Can you help me sustain this?
Yeah.
It's not when we go. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's just trying to think about, you know, those where you when you need the help, but also a lot of it's self-work.
Mm.
And we often talk about me, then we. And when we don't know who we are, it's really tough to be in a we situation.
Mm-hmm. I like that you're pointing out because, like, yes, you hit a crisis and that's when you look for support. But what's unique about this relationship crisis is that the partner sometimes is the one pointing out that this needs to happen. Because let's say you take that out of the equation here, you're not saying that to yourself. You're not saying I'm at a point of crisis. So if you looked at situations in men's lives where we're feeling crisis and it's not a relationship, how often are we just keeping to those traditional means and just doing it ourselves, right? Keeping it to ourselves, those injuries that we just retain and push through, mm-hmm. right? That you wouldn't end up seeking outward, you know, taking that step where it's no longer just private and you are reaching out to somebody. But that, I guess, is what makes it unique about a relationship crisis, is that you might see it from the other person that you got to do something.
Right. So there might be that call to action. But you see that too, like, you know, sometimes in physical kind of illness and stuff, you know, it might be the wife who says, you need to go and see someone, you're getting up three times a night to pee, like, you know, and so that, and that's the permission to go. Uh-huh. And in those circumstances, it comes from a place of care and things. And it's not to say that the ultimatums don't come from a place of care either.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes, you know, that's a pattern, especially, you know, when it's a female partner, they'll be the primary health provider in the family.
Mm.
They just assume that role, whether you're credentialed in health or not. It's like you'll get told what to do and when, because it comes again from a kind of a femininity that's about caregiving,
nurturing.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so there's some patterns.
Yeah.
To it, yeah.
Even you saying that right now, like, I'm experiencing that at a very small scale, like nothing serious, but I'm experiencing that at the moment, which is that, like, I've noticed my vision isn't as tip-top as what I thought it was before. I noticed it when I was in the line at the movie theater, and, you know, like, you can see, like, the snack board, right? You can see all the things, the menus up there, and I'm trying to read it, and I'm like, oh, shit, it's blurry. For the first time in my life, I can't read this thing that's up there. It was, like, just slightly blurry. And so my partner was like, oh, you should probably go get your eyes checked. And then, like, since then, it's come up in other ways, and mm-hmm. she's kind of reminded me, like, oh, have you thought about getting your eyes checked, like, a couple times? And it's like, it's all from a point of care, but me, like, I'm not thinking of it. I'm not thinking I need to do that, even though I probably should.
Yeah.
You know, she's the one who's suggesting it.
And typically, you know, guys, their cardinal sign is pain. Mm. So pain accompanied by dysfunction, like, I can't do X and I've got pain, that's when you go and get help. But the stuff that just kind of is benign and you're still functioning,
it's within a threshold.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I'm all right.
I can keep going.
Yeah.
It's not a problem yet.
Yeah, it's not a problem yet. Yeah, I can still read the street signs. Yeah,
I bumped into a few things. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Things not quite there.
I think there were speed bumps.
Yeah. Was that red?
Yeah. That's a rough one. I'm not sure it's red.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, it's I feel like we... This has kind of come up in a couple ways here. It's like you let these injuries build, right? Whether they're physical or emotional, before you reach a point where you need to change something about what you're doing, where what you're keeping to yourself is no longer working. And I wonder if our threshold is just naturally higher than people who don't express masculinity to the same degree. Like, are men just, like, predispositioned to tolerate? Is that even the right word to describe it? You know, to tolerate pain or discomfort to a degree for lack of wanting to take the step to change, to even explore it.
So we could think about it as an artifact of resilience. You know, so then that give 'em hell, just keep going, kind of mentality. And so somatically with our own bodies, we're often not totally in tune. And so, again, if it's not about something you can't do or pain, unrelenting pain, then it's justified away as it'll fix itself or I'll manage through it. And so, yeah, maybe we're not as cued. You know, and I see the same too, you know, with guys. We're not orientated to the healthcare system in the same ways that females might be with annual checkups, you know, reproductive checkups, perhaps, and alike. We're not, you know, we're kind of, we disappear from healthcare services, many of us from 25 to 54.
Yeah, wait for my prostate exam. Right?
You know, yeah, or not.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, well, so, you know, we're not, we don't have a relationship to healthcare. So again, and that's not to justify or make it an excusatory point, but it's just to say that might explain some of the things that we're not monitoring in a really close way.
Yeah.
In a way that we might have got orientated across our lives if we were annual checkups.
Right.
Like with nothing wrong. I mean, I couldn't imagine many guys showing up going, oh, I'm feeling really good. And that 7-minute consult would be a lot less than 7 minutes.
Yeah. I really like that you're saying this stuff, John, because this is very validating for how we've talked about the idea of men approaching mental health for a long time. Men approaching relationship problems, I think this applies to it as well. Like I obviously, and Kabir as well, like we don't have an education background in this. We just care about the topic, right? So sometimes I worry, like, am I just talking out of my ass? But to hear you saying this thing of it's like we have this resilience built in us that tells us that we, like, why go look for help if I'm not feeling any problems, right? Why go when you're feeling good? We've said that so many times, right? Why would I do something if I'm feeling good? Why would I go to someone who's supposed to fix me when I'm bad, right?
Why are we continuing to have this podcast if we're both feeling good?
Exactly, yeah. Right. If we're feeling great every week, like, why the fuck are we here, you know?
Wrap it up.
Yeah, had enough. But it's validating to me on a personal level to hear you talk about it this way, because it means that we're understanding it the right way, and that this conversation is worth having, because that's the way that we are. That's the way that men are, is that we don't go for help unless we feel like we're at a point where we can't handle it ourselves anymore. But we need to get to a place where we have tools under our belt where we are looking for help earlier than that. So that makes sense how relationship crisis leads men to kind of seek out men's mental health support, to come back to our topic we were talking about. That makes sense.
Right. And you know, that distinction too, that in the context of depression, we'll often have depressive symptoms, right? Like, they're situational. And so that's not a bad time to get a little bit of help, rather than wait for a full-blown severe depression that doesn't lift itself somehow miraculously.
Right.
Like, that the situation goes on for a longer period of time and that there's some stuff getting built in.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's just that self-triaging and just not waiting for crisis. And to the point with the relationships, it's the same. You know, when if you wait for crisis and you've withdrawn, or you're just in conflict, or you're both, like, probably it's probably not going to be feasibly fixed, and it's not necessarily going to be amicable going. You know, so either way, it's not a great outcome. And it's not to say that it could have been prevented by going earlier, but I think it could have been cushioned, and some of the work of the grief that's about to come might have got done in situ.
You may have been more prepared for it too at that point. Yeah. To that point of like relief and regret at the same time. It's like you're also in that moment, you might be relieved of the relationship, but there's also the regret of getting someone else wrapped up in your lack of preparedness and lack of being equipped to handle that moment, right, and handle that transitionary period, that time of change. So,
and I think it's about mobilizing those two things, those two emotions, to mobilize those two emotions to think about what you might have done better, not in a way of beating yourself up, but in a way of thinking, next time in, you know, assuming there's a next time, I'm gonna approach it this way. And one of the things that guys talk to us repeatedly about is the importance of communication. And, you know, it sounds like 101, but, you know, regular communication about the relationship, like actually sitting down and talking about the relationship, like not what we did last week, not what we're doing next week, but where's it going? What are the plans? How do we see this, that, like on a deep level? And I think guys are good when that's scheduled. I think it scares the bejesus out of guys when it just pops up, you know, and it just starts and you're like, oh, where are we going? Like, so guys will talk about, oh, I do so much better when it's scheduled and I can talk to it. Like I'm ready. I know it's going to be a deep level thing. I know there's going to be some stuff brought up that we can work through, but just that deep level of stuff. And I just, you know, guys tell us time and again that they need to build that in, and that's probably been blind spots for a lot of guys in relationships because there's these assumption that everything's tracking well, right, and you know, not having any arguments or whatever, and not quite picking up on things, and then, you know, out of the blue there's something that just blows up, but it's probably not out of the blue.
That's ringing true, for sure. Yeah. Like even. Like right now, I'm not feeling problems, but still, like, I don't know if I've touched base on the relationship in a while, you know, so could be worth it just to see, like, even like if I'm feeling it's good, let's make sure it is good, you know, let's bring it out there. Like, is this all good still?
I think one of the issues is it, that to me, that doesn't sound normal, but it should be.
Right.
Yeah. That doesn't sound like, you know, you could have a scheduled talk once a month or once every 2 months. That doesn't sound like things people would do typically.
Doesn't in a sound relationship, very organic.
Maybe for our age, but that definitely should be.
And at that deeper level, there's no surprises for you, but you also get to know her so much better. And that's the equity piece. And you can't do equity if you don't know the person well enough to know what they need or what they worry about or where, like, you know, sometimes conflict pops up and you don't know where it's from. Well, if you did, you know, if it was some deep-seated insecurity that was there that might be manifesting as anger in a partner, imagine if you knew that you had the conversation, that you got the trust and you got deep enough to be able to know.
Yeah.
It'd be a lot plain, a lot more plainer sailing, you know? So, again, it's that work of those what are not always easy conversations, I think, is what guys learn, you know, over time. And if you can build it in as a norm to the relationship, I think can be extremely helpful. And that's based on data and from data, guys who went through breakups. And it's also very much in the guys who talk about equitable, sustainable, intimate partner relationship. They talk about these deep level conversations that you got to build the muscle for.
Right. It's a necessity to the success of the relationship then. Sounds that way.
From what guys say. And I do, it is interesting. So oftentimes you just get into a pattern. Things are just going well. There's the annual holiday or not, you know. There's the moving in together and working all that out and that sort of stuff, and it all just rides along. But, it's – all the other, it's the emotional stuff and the attachment stuff and the intimacy stuff.
Yeah. I can find those conversations a little bit scary to approach. I've talked about, and I say scary intentionally, like I've talked about just in the episode that we had a couple weeks ago with Jessa, the therapist that I was talking to you about before we sat down and started talking here. I've talked about a fear of like conflict, or I see difficult conversations as conflict. To me, in my brain, it's just, it clicks that way. I find them difficult to approach, even though they aren't conflict. You know, like even the idea of me having a conversation about how we doing, that feels like confrontational to me somehow. And that's something that I have to just like lean through and except that it's not conflict. You know, I can have this conversation. Yeah. There's going to be good that comes out of it, and it doesn't have to be that way. But that's all up here.
Well, but it might be the pattern. Mm-hmm. The pattern is we have these deep conversations when there's a problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, so, that's so true.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, if you drain my toothpaste one more time,
We're going to have
Let's start there. Yeah. Let's start there. Yeah. You know, so it's there's a, and it's a pattern. Mm-hmm. You know, where's my shaving cream?
Yeah.
So it starts at that level, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's the problem that needs to be addressed. So it's, yeah. And if that's the only time you get those conversations, mm-hmm. then it's problem based.
Yeah.
Not helpful. So there's no.
It's just Pavlov's dogs.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Yeah, I'm just training myself, conditioning myself to say that.
So imagine negative. If it was just kind of a feel good.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Crack a bottle of wine. How are we doing?
Right.
Yeah, oh, yeah. That sounds lovely.
Turn the phone off.
Yes.
Turn the phone off. Right. Like actually undivided. Yeah, a little bit of a splash of red and a bit of a chat and but a deep. You know, we know it's going to be deep
for sure. For sure. I like that. I think I'm going to try that.
Yeah.
I'm
try Create that a new pattern.
Yeah, 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 exactly. It's like you're reshaping it, you know. Thank you for that. And John, you talked about when we had our first phone call together, you talked about a paper that you recently did about breakups specifically.
Oh, yeah.
Men getting dumped. tell us a little bit more about that in our audience, just a little bit about that and how men maybe kind of uniquely experience that.
Yeah. I think I've kind of prefaced it a little bit.
Yeah, sir. Yeah, when you're talking about breakups.
Just to say, yeah, so we were surprised about how many guys stayed in the relationship in a withdrawn state. Mm. So, and they weren't grieving the end of the relationship, though they knew the relationship was ending.
Mm.
But they didn't want to end it. They waited for the partner to end it. Then there was the conflict where they're just caught in the eye of the storm, which is the argument.
Mm.
So you can't leave and have an argument. So they wait for the argument just to get to a point where she says goodbye.
Mm.
And so these two stories, these two narratives, as we called them, were presented by 20 of the 25 guys.
Mm.
And they're stuck. And we called them impasse narratives. If you keep telling that story, if you keep telling me about, yeah, I was really withdrawn, no agency in the relationship, and then she dumped me, or we fought like cats and dogs, and then she dumped me, you know. Like if they're the and I've seen people talk about those things for years after the relationship. Like, you know, 10 years later, they're still saying, oh, I was in the relationship,
yeah.
It wasn't going well, I withdrew, got dumped, you know. And it's just like this like an auto-narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And five of the guys got to a point of this work that they had to do. It wasn't that they didn't experience those two kind of narratives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's that they took their story and changed it.
Hmm.
And their story was about, I take responsibility for my withdrawal. Why did I do that?
Hmm.
What was it about the relationship? What is it about me that withdraws? Because we're not going to talk about partner. Mm. We're going to talk about you. So it's like they do this self work about how come? And how did I get locked into conflict? Not that she was arguing with me, but how did I get into that state?
Mm.
Like, and what would I do to remedy that? Like, how would I never, ever get back to that?
Yeah.
You know, what would I do to fix?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's these five guys who really did the work of it to change the narrative. And so my point is that the stories we tell ourselves and anyone who will listen sometimes when we're ready to talk about it aren't probably that helpful if they just are going to go around like that. There has to be a point where you break that narrative and you tell a different story.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be one of regret and relief.
Mm-hmm.
But it will be about ultimately for these guys it was about self-growth.
Yeah.
Like it was about learning from it and not always about ponying up for the next relationship, like, you know, I'll get it right next time. It was about knowing themselves.
Because
oftentimes in either one of those states and those narratives, you're pretty disappointed in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And you can't do much with shame, but you can do a lot with the deep introspection about, yeah, where did it come from? You know, it's not all relational. It's not all her. I can't blame her. I can't just go on doing that. I'm going to have to really do the work of being better, of showing up better in my relationship.
And often, better for yourself.
Totally.
Yeah.
And it's easier. Like, you feel better. And it transcends other relationships. You tend to be better all round.
Yeah. Because I'm thinking, like, it wouldn't surprise me if those things, if you did that introspection and you started to think about, okay, why was I withdrawing in the relationship? Why was I resorting to conflict in the relationship and being okay with it? Like, whatever traits or qualities about you were allowing that and, like, letting that exist, probably do permeate into the other parts of your life. Right? It's more than just the intimate relationship. It's probably how you were at work. It's how you were with your friends. Like, all of those things could have, like, I'm sure could see those there. But to that point of breaking that narrative, so often you'll get the narrative of, oh, she's crazy. Like, when you break up, right? Like, it's on her. Like, nah, like, she never, like, that self-accountability, right? Mm-hmm. It can take some time to get to that point.
Yes.
And I wonder if that comes when you are the one being broken up with more often, rather, because my own experience, I've been the one ending the relationship each time it's happened. So I haven't felt that. I've never left a relationship thinking, oh, they're the problem, right? I've thought, like, oh, something about me, like, I wasn't right, you know? So luckily I haven't, and this feels like I'm, like, tooting my own horn, and I don't mean to be sounding that way at all, but it's like, luckily I have not experienced that feeling and haven't had that narrative. But I wonder then, because I haven't experienced it, if it comes from being broken up with.
In part, those narratives did come from that situation, but I'd argue that even when you decide to leave, there's regret in life, and there's some work.
Without a doubt,
there's some work. Like, so again, I chose to leave, so I'm not dealing with the rejection of having been left, or that lay in wait, waiting to be left, you know, and that abandonment, that whole thing. But the fact I've left, and I'm gonna grieve that the work that I did put in
ended in failure,
still ended in something that I'd hoped for more, potentially or not. But you know, like, so what is it that I would do next time? Like, what can I learn from it? And I think you can learn a lot from leaving.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've said that a couple of times in the past too, where it's like, it can be very hard to grow in the same environment where you were stifled.
Yes.
You know, if you are remaining in that relationship, how do you grow if it's not doing you any good and you can't get out of it?
Totally. I've got this thing, and this is not empirical, this is just thoughts that I have. And I'll share one of them with you. There's an obligation to choose wisely in terms of the partner matching your energy. So people talk about doing things together and not doing things together, having independence within a relationship, blah, blah, blah.
Yes, yeah.
I believe, and I'm no expert, but I just think that the energies have to match. So if it's about growing within the relationship, then that energy is there.
I get for what you're saying.
There's no apology for the independence, but there's a commitment to a collaborative, you know, moving forward for both of us. That's equity. Because if I need to move forward, if I need something and I need the growth, then she should pick up on it.
I see what you're saying, because from a biological standpoint, growth requires energy, like literal energy, right? So if you want to take this, like, metaphysical energy between partners, right? If you are in that relationship and you want to continue to grow while in that relationship, you both need to be willing to devote energy to that cause. That makes a lot of sense.
And that's back to that equity. What she need? What do I need?
I love that coming back full circle from the beginning.
You know, so it's just, so I think about it a lot, because I think sometimes I see folks where they're talking about, oh, he's an introvert, I'm an extrovert. I'm like, okay, so I don't believe in those traits. I think they're self-assigned psychology stuff for the most part. So then, you know, what's our state? What's our state together?
And you can come back to that asking between each other, what do you need? What do I need?
Because if we're coming off with the wrong energy and we're just not you know, synced at some level around equity, I think it's pretty tough going.
Yeah, I definitely love what you're saying here, John. And thank you so far for everything that you shared about masculinity, mental health, relationships. I think that our audience so far will have gotten lots. The last thing I wanted to ask you is more about you and to your own way of approaching mental health. But I'm wondering in particular, how has your understanding of masculinity framed the way that you look at your own mental health and the way that you take care of yourself?
Yeah. Great question. So I suffer with early autism.
Yeah.
Like full on. So what's that? I have to be early.
Sure. Okay.
Right. So, and it was pretty bad. So my point here is to, is to say, know your triggers. Right. So I would, it was so bad. I'd go to meetings and if I was late, I couldn't go in the room.
Oh, wow.
Like full on.
Huh.
So like if I was late, I just couldn't do it. So, and then I'd do this thing where I'd be anxious and crazy about getting there. So I'd be there half hour early. And that's really poor time management, typically. If you're there half hour early always, and then you're like, is the meeting happening? Is the meeting happening? Because no one's here. But, of course, I'm the only one here half hour early. So it's like full on early autism. And that's a made up word.
Yes, yeah, yeah. That's why I was laughing earlier. So like, I haven't heard that before.
So I'm like, so that was my thing. And it's my trigger. And then if you layered a new environment, the possibility that I might not know where somewhere is.
Like today.
It was good today. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, but yeah. So, you know, if I don't know where someone is, I can't read maps. I'm not really good with that stuff. Like, you know, and then new environments, like an airport that I haven't been to before. It's like, I will be there 5 hours before that thing's flying out of here. Cause again, it's just that thing. So, I think knowing your triggers is really important. So I know mine and it manifests as anxiety. So I am shocking in new environments. So over time, I have worked at changing my relationship to time. So I have to consciously calm myself. I have to eat when I would be thinking, I've got to get there, I'm not going to, and you arrive and you're just fatigued and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, so it's about building it in and the self-talk of just calming self down. And one of the ways I take the edge off what I think is a go-to state for me, as a younger man, that kind of anxiety worked really well for me. I used to work from a platform of discontent. Like, if it was edgy, I was better. It was like the adrenaline rush, but it fatigued them. So the early autism was just like a problem. So I take the edge off it with exercise. And people talk about exercise all the time, you know, like it's like something everyone's doing. We don't. A lot of times we don't do it, you know. And so I have a 5-song run. So,
yeah, you said that earlier.
You know, so I do this run. The run's really good. I'm not setting any land speed records, I can guarantee it. But the walk back, the cool down, is what's really good. Because then I just lay the day out in front of me and I stagger the appointments, I stagger the things I've got to do, I time myself in terms of, you know, every hour is accounted for, but not in a way of pressure. I started to move away from a to-do list to a to-done list. You know, and tick the things off and take some little things and just take the tension out of it. So there are a couple of the things I do that help me think through things that could be potential triggers for me. And I kind of know when they're coming up and I just know that I need to plan, but I don't need to overplan. And I just need to relax a little bit. So for me to arrive here at 7:30 was pretty
good.
Right
on time.
And I didn't panic. I did not panic today. You know, so again, just it's that self-talk. I ate before I came. Like all those things that I typically would be just like, I'll get there and I'd be here at 6:30 sitting in the car park. You know, so just trying to, that just calm, you know. Right. So got a lot of experience with that over the years, and just and it hasn't. I always felt like if I didn't have the edge, that I wouldn't be productive.
Mm. You didn't have the fire under your ass, right? Telling you exactly. You're gonna be there. Yeah.
If I'm not coming from a platform of discontent, it's like, yeah, it's going to be meek. I'm just going to roll. It's not true. It's like the productivity. It's no different, and it's actually a bit less stressful. Because if I don't hit something, I'm kind of like you know, it's just not ready yet.
Right.
Just got to be a little bit patient. Things take a bit longer, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's kind of
the way that you know how to understand yourself now,
right?
And to that point of masculinity, like fitting into that and your understanding of masculinity, like clearly everything that you've said today so far demonstrates an understanding of masculinity. And one of the themes that's come up so far in our conversation a few times is the idea of letting things just be until you can no longer handle them. But what you're saying is that you have looked inward, you've understood how you kind of operate. And because of that, you understand these triggers and you know the things you now need to do almost like preemptively in order to set yourself up for success.
Yeah. So I'm managing it, and the place it comes from, you know, my deep introspection around it is that one of my massive values is hard work.
Mm.
I never want to be seen not to be working hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of that is always being on time, always being, you know, like having the answers, you know, having that edge, right? It's a competitiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I often had marks along the way where I'd almost shadow someone to be better, sure, you know, right? So it wasn't about personal bests.
Mm.
So it came from that hard work ethic as a value, but also a degree of competitiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's always going to be someone who's better than you.
Right, right.
And so, so it sounds Pollyanna, but, you know, it's kind of like it is about personal best in the end. That's all we got.
Mm.
So just a little bit of a calming around that. So that's where that kind of that earlier-tism anxiety was coming from. It's about how will people see me?
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to be seen for who I think I am, which is the hard-working guy, and who's naturally competitive, and it just took some reframing. It took some deep thought about it.
Yeah, those are some masculine states.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Do you think that those to-do lists definitely comes from that, or to me it sounds like it comes from that earlier-tism and the feeling the need to always be hard-working? Do you feel like the to-do lists are a part of that? Or to-done lists now, as you call
them?
Yeah.
So I do tick off when something's done, because I never used to celebrate it. I'd always be like, oh, look at the to-do list. There's 20 and I've crossed two off. And it's like, oh, yeah, those lists, I do have a relationship to time. Like I
clearly, yeah.
About routine, like I value routine.
Mm.
Have I been a little bit rigid in it over the years? Yes.
Mm.
Did it serve me? Maybe it did. At certain points in my life, it might have. It was like discipline. And at other points, when you're older and you get more fatigued, it doesn't help you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I've probably changed a little bit over time as well. So the to-do list is if I'm feeling overwhelmed and I can't even triage what's next, then a to-do list can calm me. But it can also absolutely put me in an anxious state as well. Hence the to-done stuff is like, oh, all right.
This is what I've done today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got a couple of things off the list, a couple of alligator files that were just going to bite me no matter what. And I got a couple of those hard ones done.
Mm.
And I took a couple of easy gains there as well.
Sure.
And crossed them off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Did the laundry. Yeah. 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 Always, always.
Yeah. And I try to put in a personal list now too.
Mm.
I used to have a work list.
Mm.
That was it. But I put in the personal list now.
Yeah.
You know, about the other stuff. So I do know when I'm going to be running.
Mm-hmm.
I schedule in the stuff that I've got to get done, like the tax, like the birthdays, like all of those things that are kind of more a personal kind of space for me.
Yeah, not just about the job and, right. and what you do. Yeah. Yeah. The reason why I asked about the to-do list, I'm very much a to-do list person. So hearing this is like, okay, I see a lot of that in the way that I act too. Like I've always got a list. There's always something with something to do. And sometimes it feels like, why do I do this? Right. You know, I see it funny enough in my mom. My mom's retired, and I was just talking about this with her yesterday on the phone, and she's the busiest retired person I know.
Yeah.
You know, she's constantly got some new thing she's doing. She's going to some TED talk to listen. She's volunteering here, volunteering there, doing her walking club, like all these things, filling her time. And it's like, I see where I get it. You know, I see where I picked that up.
Yeah. And I see two behaviors in my parents mm-hmm. that I can see that I had exposures to things growing up that I took on and, mm-hmm. And to the point about relationships and a whole manner of things, including masculinities,
mm-hmm.
is that it's so interesting that we learn so much from our parents, but they're of a generation where we're just in a different place.
Yeah.
Generationally, because of our the work environment, the relationships are different, everything has changed mm-hmm. and changing. And so some of those things, they are social constructs about how to be as a man,
mm-hmm.
how to operate. Mm-hmm. Relationships, you grow up watching a relationship.
Yeah. In your case, no, but
you would have seen other relationships.
Yes.
Like uncles,
aunts, I was very attentive to relationships right. in TV.
Yeah.
Like that would, TV. I would see so much to try and model there, yeah. you know? But yeah.
So we grow up with these things that are not the template. Mm-hmm. And then we're thrown into this unknown circumstance mm-hmm. to try and make sense of it with someone who similarly
yeah.
is trying to make sense yeah. of it.
And each generation faces the same thing because it's a new environment each way down. You know, you're all trying to figure out how to do it again and again and again.
That's it.
But with a better understanding of how to, I think this is where the development in mental health and understanding all this sort of thing comes in play, is that we now have a better sense of learning about ourselves, which I think is going to equip people in newer generations further and further to better themselves, to be better for others. Right. Yeah. I think that'll come up that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious, and if it's okay for me to ask, yeah. about when you go back to Australia and you visit and you see your parents, do you pick up and notice these things more throughout the years, the things that maybe you have internalized and picked up from them? Like, do you reflect on that more as you get older?
Yeah.
'Cause me, I feel like at 27 and 28, I feel we're seeing that.
Yeah.
You know, sure. I think about that all the time.
Yeah. It's good that you do, you know? Yeah, absolutely. So my folks are deep in the eighth decade and,
deep in the eighth decade,
like, and lovely, mm. like just still together, I think 50, 60 years wow. later, like the whole thing.
Yeah.
And fantastic. Great characters. And yes, you do you do see things. And you see some of the qualities that you've got, mm. you know, that you grew up with, that kind of the way you are, you know, your generosity, your openness, your willingness to talk and have a nice time mm-hmm. and that sort of stuff and shoot the breeze. So lots of things make sense to me. And then there's some things where I can see that my adjustments are important and not in a critical way, but just some things that I think we see in everybody that we go, yeah, look, I'd take that. That's definitely something I want to incorporate into me. And then there's a few things that, you know, maybe I'd want to think, you know, about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't think it's any secret now. My dad has, you know, he has anxiety. He has anxious state. And so when I can see it so clearly in him, and I can see myself in him at times too. And it's just pause. It just gives me pause. So I send him podcasts about anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, and I talk to him about breaking it down and it's a lot of it's self-talk too, mm-hmm. right? But they're the things I'm, you know, here's what works for me, that, mm-hmm. you know, like here's what I think about. So I think there's opportunities to have those conversations.
Yeah.
And it's nice to be in that place, you know, that because he's open, mm-hmm. you know, like you can chat and talk mm-hmm. and it's pretty good, you know. But yeah, you can learn a lot. Mm-hmm. You can learn a lot by, you know, thinking about where things come from.
Yeah.
But also they're socially constructed, which so it means, you know, I resist the idea that it's all trait based.
Mm.
You know, that I'm somehow fixed. I've got these things that I'll never ever adjust. I think that they're learned and they're social.
Right. And that gets you to that state idea.
Yeah.
Right. Where it is something that can change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have some control. I have some level of control if I want it
mm-hmm.
to adjust behaviors.
Mm-hmm. You are malleable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think about, I never used to think about gratitude much, but I try to, this sounds so, I don't know, overdone, but I try to do something decent for someone every day.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And whether that's as simple as, you know, giving someone a bottle of water because I think they might want a bottle of water, you know, or telling someone that they've done really well and I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Just though, I that's not a natural state for me.
Mm-hmm. That's a conscious thing.
Yeah, I'm a bit harder than that typically. So, but when I do that, I feel really good. So I try to do one of those things every day.
Mm.
You know. So again, it's a feel good thing, but I feel like that's actually who I want to be.
Right. And yeah, I think that to go to the parents for a second, I think that that's a beautiful change that I think happens in a relationship between a child and a parent, because at some point you get to a place where they're no longer just your parents. They're other people.
Yeah.
You know, and you talking to your father about anxiety, like that's beautiful to me. Like, that's cool. Like you're teaching up, you know, like normally we're supposed to, we think of like, oh, we just take everything from our parents, but to be teaching them something and to be sharing something with them from our generation, our lived experience, and like returning that way, like that's so important and that's valuable in society. Like, our parents aren't there just to teach us. You reach this point where now you're both living your own lives. Yeah. You're no longer under their care. You're living your own lives and you have things that can go both ways. I think that's beautiful.
Yeah. And I think it's such an important point. One of the things is people are living longer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're in a point in history where we haven't really, you know, understood like this kind of this, you become the parent in some ways in as they get older and they're out of the workforce longer, you know, kind of become the person that's orientated to the world a bit more because they're not dealing with the technology to hold the job, all that sort of stuff. And things change, banking changes, all that, you know. So anyway, you assume that role, but I think you raise a great point, and for young guys, I think there's lots that you can share with your parents at any point, and older folks at any point, that will be really so helpful. And in terms of reciprocity, there can be really helpful exchange. Yeah. So never feel like, you know, young guys should never feel like they don't have anything to offer. Tons to offer. I surround myself with younger people at work, you know, and they just surprise me. I am so buoyed by their abilities to do things, and sometimes there's room to teach me a couple things, which I really value. Like there's actually room in it that I'll actually come away going, oh, didn't know that.
Yeah,
that's really good. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think there's a lot to be learnt from that, and guys can do it especially well.
Mm.
Like, you know, we love to kind of teach each other a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the best mentorship ways is just get that reciprocity. So I got a nephew who's 32, and you know, like he'll show me stuff, and I go, oh, that's so cool. That's so great. And some of it I can use in the everyday, deep gratitude for it, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really nice spot to kind of tie things up for a conversation here too. The idea that young men, you have something to offer always, you know, even if you're still finding your own maybe purpose in life and that sort of thing, you always have something to offer to somebody. There's conversations that you can have. You have something to bring to the table, something to bring to the world. And I think there's definitely a lot that would have been learned through our conversation today about understanding masculinity a little bit better. I mean, if it's something that can be studied for 25 years, a 1 hour conversation, 2 hours will not suffice. You know, there's more to learn, but I think this is a cool place to kind of start scratching the surface on this and dig into why or why not men will approach mental health and how we do and the way that we deal with relationships as well. I think this was a great talk. This is really cool, John. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you both so much. Yeah. I love what you're doing, and it's been a really highlight of my week.
Yeah, sweet. Hey, there we go. And Kabir was cured in the episode. Oh yeah. My God.
Twice.
Yeah. I love it, man. Everybody listening and watching, I hope that you really enjoyed this episode too. I mean, us being here, this was great, but I hope you at home are taking away just as much from this as we did. Leave a like, comment, subscribe, all that kind of stuff, and we will see you next week with another episode. Peace.